Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we have another great interview today.
I know, but as I said.
I'm excited because we have a guest with us today from all the way up.
That's right. We're in Florida.
Yeah. Oh my God. My goodness. We're from all the way up in Minnesota.
Right.
So it's fantastic. And we have a listener who writes to us on Facebook often, and she's from up in that same area, and she always writes to us about how cold it is. And so we're actually talking with someone today who's experiencing the cold in real time.
Right. And we're at about 83 or 84 today here in Florida. Right?
It's funny because just before we came on to start recording, I was asking Richard, maybe we should turn the air down because it's a little warm in here. I'm sorry.
They don't have that problem in Minnesota.
They have that problem up there. Wow. So, but we do have Dr. Sarah Langworthy with us today to talk about stress, resilience, and the effects of those things on the developing brain. So, Richard, tell us a little bit and introduce Dr. Langworthy to us.
Well, the most exciting thing about reading this first sentence is a new word for me. She's a YouTuber. I hadn't seen that one before. But she's also, besides playing around with electronic devices, she's also written some books. One of them is Bridging the Relationship Gap. And she has a YouTube channel called Developmental Enthusiast Channel, which covers the science of brain development, stress, and resilience, and provides practical strategies for working with children and families facing challenges. Sarah's also an organizational advancement, evaluation, and digital communication consultant, which means I'm going to get left behind quickly with you two talking about things that I don't know anything about. You can learn more about Sarah and her work by visiting her website, www.drlangworthy.com.
Yes. And Sarah, I'll have all kinds of links to all of her connections in the show notes.
Right. There's a whole list of Twitter, YouTube. You look a lot like Bernie here, Dr. Langworthy. You have YouTube and Twitter. And I asked him if I should get a Twitter account some weeks ago, and he sort of chuckled. And I think the little chuckle was a no. But I don't need a Twitter account, right?
No. Shook his head.
Just sort of sent a shiver through his whole body when I mentioned even Twitter in the same sentence. So, but it's good to have you here, and I'm fascinated by these topics. So we are neuropsychologists by training, and we also do a lot of work with trauma, and so we're really interested in this discussion. So welcome aboard.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I am excited to talk to you both today and share a little bit about what I've been up to and dive into some of these kind of hard topics to talk about. They're not always straightforward, and it's also not always positive, but I really believe in framing it from a positive standpoint that across development, we are able to change and grow and continue to recover and repair damage that may have happened early on in life. But I'll give a little bit of background, I guess, on how I landed in this field. And
that was our first question. Yeah. How did you end up
in here?
Right.
As I like to say to other, graduate students and professionals in the field, that sometimes in your career, it makes a whole lot more sense when you look back on it than when you're looking forward into it. Sometimes it can feel like you're in the middle of a giant field and trying to figure out where you're going to go. But looking back on it, it makes a whole lot more sense how things are connected. So I did my PhD at the University of Minnesota at the Institute of Child Development in developmental cognitive neuroscience. So basically how kids think and learn and how their brains work. And so I spent a good deal of my graduate time at MRI scanners and doing EEGs and that sort of thing. But I knew pretty early on in graduate school that I didn't want to go the traditional researcher track. Mm-hmm. That just didn't have as much as much pull for me. But what I was really passionate about and still am is this whole area of science communication. There's so much that we're learning from research and so much important information that unfortunately ends up sitting on the shelves of academia. It sits in journals and people in the real world who are working with kids and families don't have access to that information, or it's not presented in a way that is useful to them. And so early on in graduate school, I kind of knew like, oh, this is really interesting to me. And I got connected to a group here at the Science Museum of Minnesota. Several years ago, they were in the midst of developing an exhibit all about the science of early childhood. And so I got to serve as a content expert on this exhibit development team, which was cool. It was one of those experiences that I look back on and I'm like, I am so lucky that I got to do this thing. Yeah. But basically, my role was bringing the science in and saying, oh, here's a really cool concept in child development. How can we convey this to a public, to a general audience of people who are walking in off the street into the museum who don't necessarily know anything about kids? Right. How do we convey this concept to them? And it was fascinating because we would talk about a concept and then these exhibit developers would go away for a week and come back and they'd have a prototype sitting on the table the next week at the meeting. And it's just like, this is amazing. These people who constantly live in this world of thinking about how do you translate science. And so that was a really formative experience for me. And so after I finished my PhD, I worked for 5 years for the Children, Youth, and Family Consortium, which is also here at the University of Minnesota, and had wonderful experience there learning about things like community engagement and got to develop more skills around how do we translate research, how do we make it useful, doing online video, doing professional development opportunities, but then also getting an opportunity to write my book, which was fabulous to be able to do that. So so over the last several years, I've had, again, more of those experiences about how do we make science useful and interesting and also accurate. It has to be accurate. And so finding that balance can be really tricky sometimes, but it's a place that I really like living. And so recently I left the university and am off on my own doing various kinds of consulting, as you mentioned, and still continuing to do speaking and presentations and, you know, writing and reading around these topics about trauma and stress and, you know, how do we make the lives of kids and families better? And how do we help the people who are working with kids and families on a daily basis use science and understand science and find it useful to them in their daily practice?
That's great. We've talked about that before, that, again, we follow a very similar pattern here, because we do the same thing. Our goal in starting this podcast and a lot of the work that we do, you're still at the university a lot, but I left and just teach now as an adjunct. But the goal has been to shift into more community based, so that we can provide information, you know, to the people who are actually living the life of the people that we're trying to help. And we worked really hard to try to reach parents and families and those people who are really, you know, for lack of a better word, and really using the stereotypical word, on the front lines of working with children in these kinds of situations.
Paths. We were in psychiatry. We were in the at the medical school here at the University of South Florida. Mm-hmm. But we kept saying, how do we get this? We want to get this information to parents and teachers. Yeah. You know, the researcher, we were all talking to each other. You know, you go to conferences and you speak to two or three other specialists in your field. We wanted to talk to hundreds of parents and teachers because they don't have access. You're absolutely right. They don't have access to this information. Yeah. And some of the access they do have is either watered down to the point where it is inaccurate.
Right.
And people are getting inaccurate information.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So, well, let's kind of dive into some of the specific things that you talked about. And why is it important, or why have you found it important that we really work to study brain development?
Yeah. You know, for me, it's kind of always been a fascination thing. I look at little kids and I'm like, what is happening in your head? Like, this is fascinating to me. I just love thinking about what's your little brain doing? But I think from a more practical standpoint, it's important to understand the way in which experience shapes how the the body and the brain develops and changes over time. So we know from a lot of research that especially early on in life, there is this huge window of opportunity for change and growth that happens in the brain. Babies are born with, you know, billions of neurons, and then they go through this process that we call neural pruning, where experience, the daily interactions they're having with caregivers, the exploration that they're doing in their surrounding environment, those things are actually changing the shape and function of the brain. It is changing how neurons are connecting to one another. It's laying down these foundations and these pathways from which everything else will then grow. And so when I think about brain development, to me, what's really exciting is those first 5 years or so we know are that really big window of opportunity. Now, the flip side of that, obviously, is that it's also a very big window of potential peril. So we know from a lot of research, especially with institutionalized orphan-reared children, that if children don't get those daily caring interactions and don't get their needs met and don't have a chance to kind of explore the world and learn, that it actually shapes their brains in a negative way. And we know that it's actually really hard to recover from that later on. Whereas children who are adopted very early, and again, get those interactions more on a daily basis, they can recover some of that function later. So there's really that sort of sensitive period early on in life where if you catch it early and you keep building those relationships and continue giving children the opportunity to explore and learn and grow in really positive ways, that children can flourish kind of in spite of adversity. But if children are faced with a lot of stress and difficulty early in life, that can be really hard to recover from. So I think it's important when we're talking about brain development to be thinking in that frame of that this is really, really important to get it right early. Sometimes I talk to people who are like, well, but kids don't remember anything before the age of 3. So why is this important? And explaining to people that, no, literally your interaction with your baby at 2 days old is starting to form and shape those pathways in the brain that will become so essential later on in life. It's not just about what you can remember and articulate later in life. Those early experiences are really formative and shape the trajectory from the very beginning through the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. So
it's great hearing all of those examples, because there are so many factors that, I was talking to a family the other day, and they were expecting their first child, and they were saying, what should we do? How do we prepare? So we talked about, the two of the big things that we talked about was attachment, mm-hmm. what happens as soon mm-hmm. as the baby's born, how important that attachment is over the first year or so. And then we talked about just how many little things that you don't really think about that has an influence on other skills much mm-hmm. further down the child's life, like talking to the baby. You want to talk to the baby as much as you can, because we know that early exposure to language helps predict reading ability, 5, 6, 7 years down the road.
Yep.
It's amazing. So, you mentioned some of these factors that influence brain development, like experiences, that early attachment and those early connections. What other kind of things, should parents be thinking about? Let me give you some examples, because that's a very broad question. You hear these examples of, you should get your child baby Mozart and Baby Einstein.
Yeah.
And we hear these kinds of things that, these are the things that we should be exposing our kids to very early on. Mm-hmm. What do you think about those things? I'll just kind of leave it open like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I want to start with the caveat that, like, it's hard being a parent in this world, because there are so many opinions, fact-based and not, about how to raise your children, right? There are so many ideas out there about different ways to do it and the right way to do it. I want to say that at the end of the day, if you are spending time and being responsive and caring and loving your child, you are on the right track. At the end of the day, that is the goal. But also to say that you're going to mess up sometimes, right? You're going to have situations where you're like, yep, did not do that as well as I could have. That's okay too. So allowing some some forgiveness in this journey, because it is a journey that is really hard that people aren't prepared for. You know, we don't give parents a parenting manual usually when they walk out of the hospital with their newborn baby. I kind of wish we did, but that's not something that's always available. And so when you're looking for information, especially online, about how to raise your kids or things like the Baby Einstein videos, you know, I don't have a problem with those kinds of things, but I also want to say that there's no research to really suggest that they actually are going to boost your baby's brain development any more than the relationship that you're building with them if you're playing with them on the floor. Like, to me, those are the interactions that are most important. The TV cannot replace that. The iPad cannot replace that. That said, we live in a technology-driven world, and so there are going to be times when you are in the middle of something and you need to just let your kid play a game for 2 minutes while you're trying to take care of something. That's okay, too. You're not breaking their brain by letting them interact with those things. Is it changing the way their brain develops? Yes. Do we know how? Not exactly yet. The science isn't quite back on that yet. But for me, when I'm talking to parents and especially good friends of mine who are like, oh my gosh, I'm a terrible parent because I did this thing, I'm usually like, guys, just calm down. It's okay. You know, you can have those times where you're not at your best, but as long as the majority of your interactions with your child are positive and loving, as long as you are responding when they are upset, you're going to them when they need help, you're helping them understand the world, you're helping them navigate through difficult situations, whether with siblings or with peers or difficulties in transitions from different kinds of childcare experiences, you know, you're your child's biggest ally, and they rely on that really, really a lot. You know, that you are that primary relationship. And as long as you keep that at the center, and keep focused on that, the rest of it, I don't want to say the rest of it, you know, all comes together, but the rest of it is kind of icing on the cake at that point. So just keeping really focused on that central relationship and the value that you add to your child's life by being there and being responsive and being positive.
Yeah. Sarah, I have a sort of a two-part question.
Yeah.
You mentioned it's okay once in a while to hand them the iPad. You know, we used to talk about TV as babysitter.
Yeah.
You know, that your kids are better off watching TV for a half hour while you're preparing dinner. Mm-hmm. The American Academy of Pediatrics came out with those new guidelines.
Yep.
And in the guidelines, they said no media before age 2.
Yep.
Which is kind of almost draconian. And you sort of just casually mentioned if you want to hand them the iPad for a couple of minutes, it's probably okay. Mm-hmm. It is, right? It is okay?
I mean,
I think it is, but...
I mean, it's a hard thing, right? And yes, so I know the recommendations that you're speaking of, and I look at those as a... They're recommendations, right? And I think by and large, yeah, you don't want your kids having a lot of screen time, right, especially before the age of 2. Partly because, like I said, we don't actually know what that's doing to a child's brain. Right. But I also want to recognize that, like, the reality we live in is that phones and iPads and all of that are everywhere. Right. Now, it is a little bit horrifying sometimes, you know, when I'm at the restaurant and I'm seeing, you know, a young mm-hmm. child more able to interact with an iPad than they are to like turn pages of a book. Like mm-hmm. that to me is a little concerning, but if you're going to give your child, you know, something for a couple of minutes while you're trying to make a phone call, you know, that I feel that you should not feel awful about that. Right. Like there are going to be those moments again that yes, I would rather that you be on the floor playing with your kid, but if that's not your reality right now, that's okay.
Well,
but again, making sure that those times don't add up and making sure that those are fewer and farther between than you being able to play on the floor with your kid.
Right. Well, that's the second part of the question, because parents will often ask, well, if it's okay, how much is okay?
How much
is okay? And it's hard to quantify that, of course.
Right, right. Which is, I think, why the recommendations are what they are, is it's just easier to say no screen time before the age of 2. But I also think we live in a world where there are screens everywhere. It's not actually possible to do no screen time.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where they say, don't do it at all, right, knowing that you're going to do it some.
Right. Yeah.
But if they said do it for, you know, that an hour a day is okay,
yeah,
then they know that everybody would be doing 5 hours. So,
right. It becomes a slippery slope.
Yes, exactly. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. So, now one of the other things that you mentioned is that, you know, during this, these early years, a lot of these things influence brain development. And a lot of these things we've talked about have influenced the brain in hopefully positive ways, but there are certainly things that influence the brain development in negative things. Like you mentioned the children who grew up in, you know, orphanages who aren't able to develop those attachments and things like that. So in those cases, we're talking about the experience of stress and trauma and the absence of developing attachments and things like that. What do we know about the effects that those things have on the brain development?
So there's been some great work, and it's actually relatively old now. Okay, it's like 20 years old now, that's come out about these what they call adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs is sometimes how it's referred to. And it's based out of the study that basically did a reflective study with adults who indicated, you know, did you experience these kinds of difficulties early on? So they were things like abuse by a caregiver, parental incarceration, and of course, I'm going to forget the laundry list, but there are lots of different kinds. I think there were 10 or so different ACEs, as they call them, adverse experiences, that adults indicated, yes, I experienced this, no, I didn't. And the biggest finding was that the more ACEs that an adult indicated they had, the poorer health outcomes they had later. So things like heart disease and obesity and drug use and those kinds of things were more prevalent in people who had reported more adverse early experiences. And there are a couple of things about this that I find really interesting and important to outline. The first of which is something I mentioned earlier, which is that sometimes, you know, children don't remember before the age of about 3 or so. And so they may not even report report those kinds of experiences. So these are just experiences that adults can remember and acknowledge as a thing that happened to them. And so there may even be some underreporting. It's hard to know. And so that's kind of the problem with this reflective kind of study. But what's really compelling is to say, okay, even in these things that people do remember having occurred, you're seeing this strong of an effect later on in life with physical health outcomes. That's the thing I find most interesting, is that, you know, you might expect there would be mental health outcomes for that, or mental illness associated with those early experiences. And they do find that as well. But to see these physical health outcomes, I think really underscores the importance of understanding that the brain and the body are linked, and your mental health and your physical health are really linked, and that those early experiences shape not only how your brain develops, but also how your body develops. And so there's been subsequent, you know, lots of really interesting research in the stress world to indicate that even in the case when a baby is in utero, when a baby is being grown in those first few months, that the stress that a mother is experiencing actually affects the way that the stress system of the baby develops, which is scary and also really important to know, that the experiences of mom really, really, really affect baby. And so that raises all these questions about what are we doing to support mothers when they are pregnant and when they are growing their little humans inside of them, to make sure that they are supported and are not experiencing a huge range of adversity and traumas and stressors themselves, because we know that that will affect how their baby develops. And the same is true of early childhood. You know, we talked about the things that are happening early on in life and those experiences really being really shaping the way that the brain develops. You know, we need to be able to minimize those kinds of difficulties that children have to experience early in life, so as to set them up for better health outcomes later. And so I think that's one of the really interesting kind of frameworks that comes out of the ACEs study, is just understanding the ways in which those early experiences profoundly shape the human across the whole lifespan.
Yeah, that's great, because, you know, what those big studies, those ACEs studies did too, is we often think about certain populations that, you know, where we are more concerned about the development of the child, like, you know, teen pregnancy and, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. And what those studies really did was they're really introducing this idea that the stress of the mother, you know, it's not so much, it's not just what happens afterward. It's all that prenatal exposure mm-hmm. and just all mm-hmm. of those issues that the mother experiences that also influences yep. the way that the brain develops in mm-hmm. utero. And as you said, the stress response system of the child develops. It's really fascinating stuff.
Right.
The other thing I would say about stress, and this is something that I kind of have to hop on my soapbox a little bit about, which is this idea, sort of in the pop culture media world, you get this idea that that when we're talking about stress, it's like, I'm so stressed out from my job today, which is real. I want to acknowledge, like, that's a real thing. But usually when we're talking about stress and the way that it impacts brain development, we're talking about what we like to call toxic stress. So these are the chronic, uncontrollable experiences of stress that that you don't have sort of buffers from, and you don't have ways to recover from effectively. And the degree to which it's a toxic stress experience really sits with that chronic and uncontrolled nature. And with children, it's especially difficult because they may not have the sort of coping and self-regulation abilities to cope with stress in the same way that adults might. And so that's where they really rely on their caregivers to help buffer them from those experiences of stress. And so if the whole family is experiencing toxic stress, it can really have some profound consequences, because if mom is struggling under all, or mom or dad are struggling with a lot of stress, that affects the way the interaction with the child happens.
Right.
And then the child is also in this context of stress. And so it kind of compounds and builds upon itself. And so figuring out ways to best support children and families who are facing a lot of these kinds of really difficult early life things, and helping parents understand how to continue to be that responsive and supportive caregiver, even in the context of stress. Like, there are ways to do that on a daily basis that can be really helpful, even if you're in this larger context of living in a stressful experience.
Yeah. Sarah, on the opposite end of that spectrum, mm-hmm. we read some much less about neglect than we do about mm-hmm. stress. The effects, there's some literature to suggest that the effects of neglect may be as profound as the effects yep. of toxic stress. Can you talk about that some?
Yeah. So neglect, I mean, in a lot of ways, I would put neglect in the category of toxic stress. And so neglect is basically the lack of mm-hmm. something. Usually when we talk about neglect, it's like the lack of that adult-child relationship, that the adult is not being responsive to the child's needs. And so we know from a lot of literature that that can have, as you said, really profound consequences for how children understand the world. And one of the studies that that I like to talk about when I'm talking to professionals or to parents about this are some of the emotion face processing mm-hmm. Research. Sure. I don't know if you guys are familiar yeah. with that, but basically neglected backgrounds or who have experienced a lot of neglect have more difficulty differentiating between different types of emotional facial responses and expressions, because they don't have that experience, which is one of those like, oh, well, I, you know, we know how to interpret different facial expressions pretty easily. Most people, you know, you can kind of read, okay, is somebody angry? Is somebody sad? Is somebody happy? Is somebody, you know, upset? What, you know, what's that facial expression look like? But you think about a child who doesn't have a lot of experience interacting with a caregiver, of course they wouldn't necessarily have as finely tuned understanding of those different facial expressions. And then you think about how that might play out in, say, an early care environment. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that happens in those early care environments, right? There's a lot going on and a lot that's required of young kids, including the ability to recognize facial expressions. You know, that is a task that we all have to do on a daily basis to some degree. And so you think about children who are basically kind of behind in that already, And of course, it's going to create some tension and some difficulty because they're not understanding like why, what's happening here. I don't get it. Which to a care provider can look really strange and can be sort of like, why are you having trouble with this? This should be pretty easy for you because you're a four-year-old or whatever. So I think when we're talking about understanding children coming from neglect and also from abuse as well, similar kinds of issues with understanding facial expressions, I think it's helpful for providers to kind of step back and go, okay, what's the broader context here? You know, you probably have expectations about here's what a four-year-old looks like or a four-year-old should look like. This child is acting a little bit outside of my expectation here. Why is that? And understanding that it might be something like neglect. It might be something like abuse. It might also be that this child is just a little bit different. And so doing a lot of that kind of trying to get that curiosity and asking, okay, what's going on here? Let's kind of unpack this a little bit and see what behaviors we're seeing and what that might be indicative of, kind of being a little bit of an investigator, as I like to put it. I think that can be really helpful because sometimes we respond to behaviors so quickly that we kind of have that knee-jerk reaction that this child is doing a bad thing, as opposed to thinking like, okay, why is this child reacting this way? So it's not so much about why did you do that? It's more about what happened to make you do that, to make that be your response to something.
Yeah. And I think what's so interesting too is the idea that, you know, we can have a stress response or a child can have a stress response to something that is a stress response to that child, but may not be necessarily elicit a stress response from another child. And so we get into the whole idea of the individuality of it, because people will say, well, you know, well, that wasn't a very stressful situation or everything turned out okay. Why is he responding that way? Or why would he experience stress because of that? And, you know, it is to that individual a very stressful thing.
Well, and I think that's a great point too, especially when we're talking about trauma. One of the things that I like to emphasize is that it's kind of all in the eye of the beholder, right? There are situations that others may deem as traumatic, but if that person who is experiencing it doesn't experience it as a traumatic event, and if they have relationships to help buffer them and coping strategies and that sort of thing, to them, it may not be traumatic in the same way that we would project on it. So I think it's always important for people to kind of shift their frame too, in terms of labeling things as a traumatic experience, understanding that, okay, maybe for this person it wasn't, or maybe this thing that seems pretty normal to me actually is very stressful and traumatic to this individual because of the larger context they live in, because of the experiences they've had. There are any number of reasons why. And instead of trying to label it based on our understanding of the world, making sure that we're shifting and trying to live in that person's shoes a little bit too and understand, okay, maybe this child is reacting in this way because they've experienced XYZ over here. Mm-hmm. And I need to understand that and adjust my reaction to them based on that understanding.
Right. So with a lot of our conversation, we've been talking about sort of development in this broad context. And when we think about development, of course, we think about, you know, sort of the five big areas of motor development and cognitive development and social, emotional, and what areas, or are there particular areas that are more affected by some of the stress and trauma than other areas?
I mean, yes, probably. When I think about stress, when I think about recovery and this concept of resilience, which we haven't really talked about yet, but to me, a lot of it is based in those relationships. Relationships is really the important factor there. So though, yes, stress and trauma may affect motor development, to me, where the healing opportunity lies is really in those relationships, because young children are so dependent on relationships early in life. They are so formative. You mentioned attachment earlier. That is such an important foundation for everything that comes later, that to me, where those opportunities for recovery and for resilience really lie are in those relationships with caring, supportive adults. And so for me, the social emotional aspect of brain development is perhaps, I would argue, one of the most important, especially early in life, but I would say across the lifespan, that relationships have the capacity to heal in ways that cognitive interventions might not. Now, that said, is it better if you're having, you know, positive relationships and then also getting, you know, some cognitive treatments? Yes, probably. But I think that really the core of understanding development is that we are a social species. We do interact in the context of relationships, and that those relationships are really, really powerful.
Yeah.
I want to get to resilience, though, because that's something I want to spend some time on. Before we do, can I ask you one quick question? These preschool, this is sort of kind of a political question. Head Start.
Yeah.
There's conflicting opinions about Head Start. My understanding of the literature is that it works well. What is yours?
Yeah, this is a hard one. Excuse me. I would say that there is some conflicting research about how effective Head Start is, and in terms of long term, especially. Yeah. Now, my perspective on that is that the intervention of Head Start itself is really powerful, but if we're not also intervening with parents and families and communities and policies and larger systems that are continually affecting children, then we're missing the boat, because you can do all of the intervention at an individual or at a small micro level that you want. But if you're not willing to then say, okay, how are we going to better train parents so that when their children get to third and fourth grade, they also can help support them at continually moving on, you know, or if we're not willing to do interventions in our school systems to support mental health or to support, you know, all of these other issues that impact kids, then yeah, all the intervention in the world might not make that much difference, even if it is targeted in this really important early childhood window. It has to be continuous and it has to be systemic. And that's a thing that we run into a lot, is that we try to do these interventions on a very micro level without considering or without being willing to tackle the larger systemic and contextual issues facing children and families.
Good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And one, I too am very eager to get to resilience, but you know, you mentioned earlier, and we were talking about sort of those first 3 to 5 years of life. Does that seem to be a more critical period as it relates to exposure, or that seems to be more influenced by the exposure to stress and trauma and things, or is that throughout childhood, or is there any research on that?
Yeah. So normally we do talk about the first 5 years of life as being maybe not the most important, but really, really, really important, because all of the foundations of brain development and of, you know, social interaction and of behavior, all of those are starting to happen and are happening in those first 5 years of life. You think about the developmental tasks that happen between 0 and 5, and it's kind of amazing. Like, I look back in the last 5 years of my life and I'm like, yeah, I mean, I did a lot, but if a 5-year-old looks back on their last 5 years of their life, it's an incredible amount of change. You went from literally not being able to do anything except for cry and poop to being able to, you know, interact with peers and talk with people and play and self-regulate a little bit. And, you know, all of those things that children have to learn in those first 5 years are so foundational to how they'll be later. And so we know that if we interject a lot of stress in those early years, that can have more significant repercussions later. That said, you know, stress across the lifespan is a thing, and that we should not ignore. But we know from the brain development literature that those first 5 years are when there's this huge spike in growth and change in the brain. Now, that said, we also are finding that there is this sort of what we're calling second window of opportunity happening in adolescence. So right around puberty, there's been some research to suggest that there's a lot more, again, neuronal change and brain changes and restructuring and reorganization that's happening during that window. And so people are starting to recognize that, okay, that may be a second really powerful window of opportunity so that, you know, when you get through those first 5 years and you think, oh man, this is, you know, this child's really struggling, they've had all of these experiences, to not lose hope, because there is continued opportunity for change and growth, and that adolescence window is one that we may want to continue to target and think about how do we target our interventions around that second window, because there's a lot of transition happening in that puberty time too. And again, in the tasks that youth are asked to do during that period. And so how do we, with that knowledge that there's a lot of change and growth happening in the brain, how do we capitalize on that to recover from what may have been difficult early on?
Mm-hmm. Perfect. So we've arrived at resilience, because now what we're talking about is how,
yeah, what do we do?
Let's just start out. What is resilience? What are we talking about when we try to identify factors associated with resilience?
Yeah. So one of the professors at the Institute of Child Development, her name is Ann Mastin, Dr. Ann Mastin. She is sort of one of the people in resilience, in the resilience research world. And she refers to resilience as ordinary magic, that it arises from and in the context of these everyday experiences and interactions. So it's not something that some people have and other people don't. It's something that we can all access to varying degrees, depending on our situation in life and depending on what's happening around us. And so resilience is really this idea that there are things in our lives that we call protective factors, things that help us cope with difficult situations. And then there are things that we call risk factors, which are, you know, a lot of the things we've already talked about, these, you know, stressful experiences and, you know, living in unsafe neighborhoods. And there's a laundry list of these difficult things that you might have to go through. But if you can rely on what we call these protective factors, so things like positive and supportive relationships with caregivers, positive relationships with peers, things like the belief in a sense of hope or purpose in life, you know, supportive communities, those kinds of things can be really helpful in buffering people against the effects of things like stress and other risk factors that they might experience. And so when you think about growing resilience, it's not a magic pill. It's not a, you know, multi-million-dollar intervention necessarily. It's having one supportive person in your life that you can rely on when you're dealing with something that's really, really difficult. You know, can you connect to that person? Are there other ways, other things that you can rely on in your life to help buffer you against those experiences of stress? So, so this idea of resilience, I think sometimes gets a little bit misunderstood. In fact, there's the term resiliency, which is thrown around a lot, which, depending on your perspective, it could be construed to be understood as a personality trait. It is either something you have or something you don't. What I really like to think about with the context of resilience is that it's not about something you have or don't. It's about what's your current experience and what factors do you have right now to deal with the stress that you are facing right now, and understanding that may change over the lifespan. So recently, I did a video on my YouTube channel called Harry Potter and the Ordinary Magic of Resilience, where I outlined this topic of resilience and protective factors and risk factors, and talk about the different Harry Potter characters and how they represent those different experiences, and emphasize that over the course of those 7 books, Harry, as a model of resilience, his ability to access those protective factors to buffer him from stress changes across that time. There are times when he's really able to cope, and there are times when he's not. And that's kind of the hallmark of resilience. It's not that you're always going to be resilient in every situation. It's in that moment, can you access those factors in a way that helps buffer you from this particular experience? And it may change week to week, month to month, year to year. It's fluid and continues to change. It's not something you either have or you don't.
Great. Hmm. That's a lot of dense information.
Yes, sorry.
That's great.
I wasn't ready for that one.
it makes me really want to. I'm definitely going to check out Harry Potter. Yeah, because you're absolutely right. It's and I love it that so many of the great authors and you know, creative folks demonstrate that these kinds of things so well, and then we can relate it to in ways that make sense and are understandable.
And we talk in our practice, we talk a lot about you have to put children in. You have to create sort of little stressful circumstances so that children experience failure, they experience falling short. And what you're, I think I heard you saying is, this gives parents and teachers a chance to sort of teach and develop resilience. That's what you're giving them.
Yeah. So that actually goes back a little bit to stress. So I mentioned toxic stress before. One of the other categories, there are three categories that we use when we talk about stress. There's toxic stress, there's tolerable stress, which is basically really stressful experiences that you can recover from because you have these supportive relationships and other protective factors that we were just talking about. And then there's positive stress. So though that stress is the sort of everyday experiences that you have in life, that kind of throw you for loops a little bit, but help you develop that stress system and how to respond, how to cope, those kinds of things. So I think about, like, right now I'm a little bit, you know, stressed out, a little anxious, like, oh, this podcast thing, they're recording me, and oh gosh, oh, am I saying stupid things, you know, but I know that at the end of our recording, I'll come back to kind of a normal state and be a little less anxious and a little, you know, a little more calm. So for kids, it's really important to have those positive stress experiences. So yes, stress is actually important for kids to experience in small, time-limited, supported doses. Right. So building those skills, because it helps children build those skills of regulation. How do I cope when something in life throws me for a loop?
Right.
You know, do I completely lose my mind? Maybe at first, but if I learn that if I'm feeling really anxious, I can go talk to my parent and say, I'm really anxious about this, help, you know, or express that in some way, then the parent can help them with those coping strategies to kind of recover back to normal again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. It makes me think of a story that I've told before with my son when he was younger. He used to play baseball. He's much more of a soccer player now, but when he used to play baseball, and there was this game and he was pitching, and he was never a really big kid. He never really threw hard, but he threw accurately. And he was having this really difficult baseball game.
Soccer match.
He was having this really challenging game, and he was struggling this one inning. He was not getting, he only had one out, and he was having a hard time. And so I walked out, as I was walking out, because I was coaching, he just kind of looked so down and so stressed and so overwhelmed. And I went out there, and he just kind of looked up at me, and I said, so where do you want to go for lunch afterwards?
Oh.
He goes, what? I go, where do you want to go get something to eat? I was thinking about we could get some burgers or something. And he goes, I don't care. And he goes, I go, just throw the ball. And then I walked away, and he struck the next two guys out. But,
yeah.
You know, teaching that way to cope with that stress. As parents, we have so many of those opportunities. We just have to be able to recognize them and use them and take it, you know.
Well, and I love that, because I think it's this great reminder, right, that this frustration that you're experiencing right now is temporary.
Right.
We're going to go to lunch after this, and it's going to be fun. We're going to go, you know, this is going to end, basically, is what you told him. And like, in that, and like, oh, okay, this isn't the end of the world. Like, my world isn't going to fall apart if I lose this game. But I can kind of be comfortable in this again, and yeah, kind of relaxing into the moment again by the reminder that, like, this too can end, and it will pass, and it will be okay.
Right. And it kind of brings us to the idea of fostering resilience.
Right. That's right.
You know, we want to, as parents, you know, we want to, as psychologists, we want to help teach parents how they can foster this resilience in their children.
Sarah, is it accurate to say that you would put resilience in a column of self-regulation?
I would say they're very related concepts. And I would say that regulation is a cornerstone of resilience, and is a skill that is important for resilience, but I wouldn't call them the same thing necessarily.
Okay. But would you consider resilience in the category of self-regulation?
Again, I think they're related. So the way that I would the way that I would think of it is that self-regulation, you know, we call it self-regulation, and this is a whole different conversation potentially, but we call it self-regulation because it's this ability to regulate or to control your own responses to things, right? This ability to cope and understand, you know, this situation is happening. Here are the skills I can use to control my own behavior and work through this situation and move forward.
Right.
But the development of that is so crucially built in the context of relationships that to me it's very tied to resilience, because they're similar tasks, but I would still parse them out as slightly different. You can have self-regulation skills and not be resilient in a moment, right? But if you're being resilient to a particular situation, you might be using self-regulation skills. You probably are. The other part of this is, as I said, these skills that you learn about self-regulation are built through those back and forth interactions that you have with caregivers early on in your life. Mm-hmm. So if you think about little babies, in the first, 6 months, they don't have any ability to regulate their own responses, right? They cry and they depend on a caregiver coming and meeting their needs. Sure. They cannot meet their own needs. Mm-hmm. But then you start to see, even at 6 months or so, if they've had exposure to those supportive and caring responsive relationships, they might wake up in the middle of the night and cry out. But if they hear a parent's footsteps on the floor or on the stairs, they might be able to kind of calm a little bit. They might recognize, okay, my needs are going to get met soon. I'm okay. Mm-hmm. It's that continued process that then continues to happen across you. Preschoolers, you see them, or toddlers, you see them freak out for no particular reason, but then they come and check in with their caregiver. Caregiver's like, yeah, you're okay. You're going to be fine. It's okay. I'm sorry that hurt you, but you're going to be okay. And then they can recover and go back to playing again. So those constant back and forth relationships and those interactions, that's what builds those self-regulation skills. That's what builds that resilience. So they're very interrelated concepts, but I would say that they're still different, because resilience is not only self-regulation. There are other components that are a part of resilience that are sort of decoupled from that, but they are really related, I would say, in that self-regulation is really important for being a normal human, but also for being resilient to stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned several things, especially early in childhood, that we as parents can do to help foster resilience by, you know, meeting the needs of our children, kind of being consistent, mm-hmm. developing that attachment, and mm-hmm. Making sure that you are there to meet their needs and to help them feel secure that mm-hmm. they're going to be helped and that their stress is going to recover from their stress.
Yep.
Are there other strategies either during that first 5 years or even, you know, as a child continues to develop, strategies that parents can use to help foster some of this, mm-hmm. resilience?
Yeah. I think one of the things that comes to mind immediately for me is the concept of helping children understand and being able to articulate their emotions. So I'm sure if I ask the two of you right now to conjure up the feeling of disappointment, you kind of know what that feels like. Now, the feeling of frustration, okay, it's related, but a little bit different maybe. And then the feeling of anger, right? Those are very different feelings to us. And we can kind of identify in ourselves, what does that feel like? Now, how did we learn that that's what that is, right? Somebody told us, somebody explained to us, oh, what you're feeling is disappointment. People, and even if they didn't say, like, specifically, well, your hands are clenched and your face is all scrunchy, and so therefore you're mad, there's that language discussion of emotion that happens throughout childhood in explaining to children, like, I understand that you're mad right now, but this is how, you know, this is how we should act instead, or that sort of thing. That coaching and that continued explanation of different feelings is something that's really crucial and subtle, but we don't always think about it. But a lot of times with kids who've experienced a lot of trauma and stress early in their lives, you see that they don't necessarily understand the different variants of an emotion. So they may not understand that if somebody, you know, knocks their blocks over, that's maybe not a reason to get really angry and upset and throw things, right? that actually that's a disappointment. Like you're bummed out that this person knocked over your blocks. That can feel different and should feel different than the really angry, hot white rage, right? The coaching children through those different discrete feelings and giving them names for those feelings is a really powerful way to help children understand what's going on in their bodies. And I would say that's across the lifespan, right? You think about youth and adolescence, there are different kinds of emotions and you know, trials and tribulations that they're experiencing during that time, that the more you can give language to that and the more you can express that you understand what they're feeling, that again builds that connection, and it also signals to them that there are ways to talk about feelings and there are ways to understand their feelings in a more cognitive way. So they can kind of not step out of their feelings, but there's a way to kind of say, okay, this is anger. This is what this feels like. I know what this is like. Here's what I can do to help myself recover from it. So again, goes back to that self-regulation and resilience piece of coaching children through their emotions and how to deal with their emotions. And understanding happiness is a similar sort of thing. And actually with stress and trauma, we see that a lot where children may understand anger quite well, but they don't know what happiness feels like sometimes. And so you have to identify for them, oh, you're smiling. You can smile for this. This is really great. This is happy. You know, those kinds of things. Again, that language to give children that understanding of what's happening inside of them and then subsequently how to cope with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. The other thing that happens in adolescence is that they begin to have the cognitive ability to recognize that they can experience two emotions at the same time. Mm-hmm. You can be both excited and worried at the same time, or excited and anxious, or scared and happy. Like when you watch horror movies, you know, you can enjoy a horror movie, but be, you know, scared out of your wits at the same time.
Right.
So, and that's really complicated because younger kids, I think about young kids who, you know, whose parents allow them to watch really scary movies, the kids can't differentiate because they're just not, they don't have that abstract high order thinking yet where they can separate an enjoyable film from being really scared.
Right.
So luckily that comes up in adolescence where they're able to do that. And, and it just adds a whole new layer understanding of those emotions,
but it also requires that foundational understanding,
right?
In order for them to understand that complexity,
right? Yeah, exactly. So, we have really covered a lot of territory here,
a lot of information.
Anything else? I think I'm out of questions.
Okay.
For that one, right?
Well, I would love to hear.
Say Sarah's out of answers. No.
I could talk all day, you guys. You got to shut me up eventually. I would be curious to hear from you, based on your practice and your experience. You know, what are your reflections on concepts like resilience and how do you see that play out in the families and kids that you work with?
I think that it's obviously so important. I do often find it challenging at times when you have to. You know, you see kids who have had certain experiences, and you know, certainly sometimes in the area that we're in, it's really difficult to help parents understand that we're talking about an 8-year-old who has 8 years worth of experiences that we're trying to resolve and manage. Because you know, how often do we hear, well, you know, he's only 8, what does he have to be stressed about? And it's like, what? Well, he really has a lot of stuff going on inside his head that he's trying to make sense of. It's really difficult. It's not that easy. And that to me has been some of the biggest challenges that I've had in working through some of these kinds of issues.
For me, it's been, I think, two things. One is and you mentioned this earlier, the accurate identification of emotion, getting the right word, you know, what is the word that you need? Frequently adults will say, well, I'm frustrated, but that doesn't really identify precisely what your emotion is. And I like to work with kids on identifying their emotions. But the other thing is, it's okay to have the emotion. It's what do you do about it and how do you express it? It's not okay to hit your brain. It's okay to be angry. You can't slap your sister, you know, when you're angry.
Exactly.
You hit her in the head with a truck, you know. Right. So that's the other thing that we spend a lot of time working on is how do you express it?
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, separating feelings and behavior, that your feelings don't have to control your behaviors, and in fact, probably shouldn't.
Should not, right. Yeah. Most cases, that's not a good relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Sarah, you have to come back.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
More of this. Okay.
It was delightful.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and again, I'm definitely going to check out the Harry Potter talk.
Hey, let me ask you this now. You're in Minnesota. Is Virginia Berninger there?
The name does not ring a bell.
Berninger. Okay. I didn't know whether she was there because she's at one of those centers and I didn't know whether it was Minnesota or Washington. She may be at university.
No, she may be there. Yeah, I don't know.
Sorry, he does that to me all the time.
Say, do you know so-and-so?
He'll like mention the name and it's like, I don't know.
It's better than me. It's better. Okay, never mind.
Fair enough. I get it. It happens. I understand.
Talk about stress. Trying to build up my resilience. I'm learning how to cope with this. This has been fantastic. There is so much here that listeners will be able to hopefully be able to understand and can take and start to maybe even implement in life. So and again, I will definitely post on the in the show notes so that people can link with you and follow the work that you're doing, because this is all we were checking out your website and everything earlier. Mm-hmm. There's loads of fantastic stuff on there, so we'll get everybody headed that way.
Yep.
Yeah, great.
Even I will be connected.
Woohoo! you seem a little skeptical, Bernie.
With good reason.
I will connect him to it. I will be the conduit through which he will be connected. Oh,
gosh. Yeah. So. Well, and if I could just close and say that that for parents and professionals out there who are working with young kids, like the work you're doing is incredible and also hard. And I have profound respect for that, and it's not easy. And, to just encourage people to keep thinking about, how do I best support this kid, and how do I help them with what they're struggling with now and help them move forward and be a responsive and positive presence in their life. And then you're doing the right thing. You're moving the right direction. And then that's really the key for me.
Well said. Well said. So, all right. Well, again, you are welcome back anytime.
Yeah.
Anytime you have anything else that you want to promote or just another idea that you'd like to share and talk with us about, you are always welcome.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was a lovely conversation. I enjoyed it.
Awesome. So
we did. Thank you, Sarah.
All right.
Thank you. Well,
so that's it for today. So until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.